Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, July 5th, 2012. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm delighted you could join me this evening in the United States. It's a holiday weekend evening, or coming into a holiday weekend. Yesterday was the 4th. I'm speaking to you from Cincinnati, Ohio, where I'm based for the summer. We had a great lunch with subscribers last Saturday on June 30th. Wonderful discussion, and we tentatively scheduled an event in Port Clinton, Ohio, for the last weekend of August. More on that when it comes to fruition. I've got several events for C-Lane in California and the San Francisco Bay Area in September, October, and then we'll have a subscriber lunch in Nashville in early December. You can learn more about it. Sign up at the blog. Tonight, Dale Dougherty, editor of Make Magazine, joins me to talk about the maker movement. It's experiencing explosive growth around North America and the globe. It's something you absolutely want to know about. In the blog post, I put up a lot of very good links, and if you don't know about the maker movement, I highly suggest you explore them, and I really think this is going to be a great interview tonight. Our theme tonight is Physics Goes Mainstream. Ron Paul and his efforts got people learning about monetary policy who I swore could never begin to understand fiat currency or fractional reserve banking, and yet, sure enough, the mainstream got the education, and now we see announcements coming from the Collider in Switzerland that are creating lots of interest in physics. This week, an announcement by scientists in Switzerland working with the Collider that they found a subatomic particle that behaved like a Higgs boson particle. That makes it clearly the story of the week. It's got the scientific community abuzz, but it's all over mainstream, too. There's more at the blog to help you understand what this exactly may mean, and that something can, in fact, come from nothing and why it matters. Money and markets, the Eurozone troubles continue. It wasn't just good news coming out of Europe, but bad news. We saw the markets rally early in the week ahead of the holiday here in North America on the theory that the ECB had gotten expanded powers and emergency loans could be made, Italy and Spain declaring that Merkel's position had softened. The response, of course, was that one of Merkel's coalition partners threatened to topple the government if Merkel agreed to emergency loans without rigorous conditions. And then we saw Finland and the Netherlands, the Dutch prime minister, also not in favor and demanding either preferred positions for creditors or collateral. And it all made you wonder, Merkel, who was trained as a physicist, you kind of wonder if she's questioning her decision to leave science for politics. Very much in the news on both sides of the Atlantic were interest rates. We saw mortgage rates hit ever even new lows. Coming from Copenhagen, Denmark, and this is on the blog, Denmark's central bank cut interest rates by a quarter point on Thursday. What that resulted was in a secondary rate that was literally negative, which means you're paying them to hold your deposit. Now, we've seen that happen before during the Depression. For a short period of time, we had U.S. Treasuries trading at a negative interest rate in the secondary market. We've seen Swiss bonds go negative in the secondary market, but for interest rates to turn negative in a primary market by the issuer, that's a new one, at least it is to me. Send it in if you have another example. But what it means is we have too much paper, too many financial assets, and not enough solvent governments to back it up, and we just keep printing. Got one missive from a Swiss money manager last week saying that financial assets have literally doubled since 2007. His numbers didn't include derivatives. Lord only knows what it would be if we included derivatives. The other thing that has interest rates in the news is the LIBOR scandal. Barclays settled with Department of Justice, the settlement announced this week, over rigging LIBOR interest rates. LIBOR is an interest rate that is used as the basis for literally trillions of dollars of contracts throughout the financial markets globally. There seems to be great upset about this, and it's got me sort of shaking my head. The LIBOR rigging is part of, right now we're in a world where markets are rigged, access to capital is rigged, the cost of capital is rigged, not just in the interest rates, but through monetary policy and policies in the bond and stock market. That's what central bank intervention is. If you dig down and understand all the squabbling about the management of the gold market or of the equity markets, that's what it's all about. If I can determine a rigged cost of capital for one group of players very different than another group of players, it has just extraordinary impact on the economy and who wins and who loses. That's what all of these conversations have been about. So why anybody thinks the LIBOR scandal is anything other than the tip of the iceberg of a much bigger problem, which has been part of the debate or has been at the front and center of the debate about all of this rigging. So why exactly this is such a big brouhaha, it's not really clear. My big question is this part of the push to get the Brits to go along with the European Union's institution of a financial tax. Let's see. The European Union sanctions went into effect on July 1st. Today's July 5th, so they've been in effect literally 4 days. This is a big deal. We have Iran pushing to threaten to shut the Straits of Hormuz. We see all sorts of sort of issues in Asia as Japan moves forward with government insurance, saying they will not import Iranian crude in July, but that means they're turning on nuclear facilities, and great upset among the population, of course, that nuclear facilities are going live again. In the meantime, Japan and China have done a renminbi deal, and we saw announcement this week that Chile is now doing one with China. What that means is China and these countries can circumvent the dollar. It wouldn't surprise me if we saw deal after deal after deal of countries agreeing to swap and trade going around the dollar. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens there. If you look at what's going on, the tensions, it's a long, hot summer in the Middle East. We see Saudi Arabia moving troops up to the Jordanian border, Turkish troops on the move after Syria is said to shoot down a Turkish plane. We have the UN monitor in Syria calling for efforts to end growing violence inside the country. And so the politics in and around who controls the Middle East and around oil are getting ever more tense with the EU sanctions going on. Again, a long, hot summer in the Middle East, but a long, hot summer in the U.S. as well. We saw the Supreme Court uphold Obamacare, defining it as a tax. It was the first good political news for the president. Peggy Noonan has an excellent editorial on the decision from the Wall Street Journal and what it meant politically. That's up on the blog. You can check it out. Again, long, hot summer. We had a drought throughout the states. About 90% of the country is experiencing drought and real water problems, and of course we see wildfires in some places. As an example story up on the blog, Michigan is expected to lose 90% of its apple crop. All the drought is pushing the ag commodity prices up, but it's still bad news for farmers, especially with their energy and other expenses up. We see an announcement from San Bernardino in California that they are exploring using government expropriation powers with approval of judges to seize and write down mortgages for homeowners. This is one I can't wait to see the court filings on. But essentially what they're saying is they're going to seize, and in fact they're working with investors to force the renegotiation of mortgage with private mortgage-backed security holders. That's one I'm going to be keeping a watch on. I put a video of Matt Taibbi and Eve Smith on Bill Moyers up talking about the importance of pushing banks into a utility kind of business model, since this is where I think the plan is to go. It's not surprising, but I'm stunned by the fact that there's no comment on the amount of money that's been stolen through the banks or any suggestion that we ought to get it back. The reality is if the only result is we convert the banks into utilities now that all the money has been stolen, the message is, once again, that crime pays and the people with now $27 trillion will come back and have their way politically. We had more announcements of natural gas deposit finds in North America, this time Apache Corporation announcing the extent of its new reserves in British Columbia. The finds over the last decade, combined with the new fracking technology, is now creating gas reserves sufficient to provide more than a century of energy self-sufficiency in North America, and it continues to be one of the bright spots in the economy. And it is not to be underestimated in the strength that it could give to the U.S. economy over the next decade and U.S. manufacturing. Again, if you haven't listened to the great interview we did with Jim Norman, I would really recommend it. More bad news for coal, though, as natural gas prices stay highly competitive, but also the Federal Court of Appeals ruled that EPS has the right to regulate greenhouse gases. That's going to impact power plants, and again, bad news for coal. It's up on the blog. It's off the homepage now, but if you go back, you can find it. And that decision came out right before the Supreme Court decision for Obamacare, so that was two very, very important court decisions for the administration. We saw a news Myths and Truths. It's a peer-reviewed study out of King's College in the UK. It challenges claims that GMO foods are safe. Well, let me just read you some quotes from it. Research studies show that genetically modified crops have harmful effects on laboratory animals in feeding trials and on the environment during cultivation. They have increased the use of pesticides and have failed to increase yields. Very important point. Our report concludes that there are safer and more effective alternatives to meeting the world's food needs. Another quote, crop genetic engineering as practiced today is a crude, imprecise, and outmoded technology. It can create unexpected toxins or allergens in foods and affect their nutritional value. Recent advances point to better ways of using our knowledge of genomics to improve food crops that do not involve genetically modified. Over 75,000 of all genetically modified crops are engineered to tolerate being sprayed by herbicide. This has led to the spread of herbicide-resistant superweeds and has resulted in massively increased exposure of farmers and communities to these toxic chemicals. Epidemiological studies suggest a link between herbicide use and birth defects and cancer. That study is up on the blog, and it's exactly how it made it out, I don't know, but there's some brave and fearless people there. Wild cards. Last week we saw some very significant cyber attacks in U.S., Europe, Latin America, and on a variety of financial systems. The object was to siphon money from high balance bank and credit union accounts. And it was noted that this time they were not only hitting the bigger banks, but some of the smaller banks too. We did a wonderful Solari report on identity theft, and if you haven't been touched by identity theft, it's something that you want to know about as the economy struggles. These are the times when you have more and more of this kind of fraud, and we all need to be on the lookout. And so if you haven't listened to that one, I strongly recommend it, and please make sure you do a great job of keeping your financial records and keeping your passwords and other secure data. If you do banking online, keep your passwords off of your computer and be very, very diligent in how you handle those. A couple of questions in Ask Catherine. Does Chief Justice Roberts have a file that resulted in his Obamacare decision? The writer notes, as they asked the question, saying he changed his decision and was red-eyed when he read it. This issue, I don't know the answer to that question, but I would presume if you look at the importance of that decision to the administration and the importance of that decision to centralizing control over the healthcare system, I would imagine the political pressure on the Supreme Court justices was extraordinary, and certainly it would be the most extraordinary on the Chief Justice. We're going to have investigative reporter Nick Bryan on the first week of August and talk a lot more about control files. He's the author of a new book on the Franklin cover-up, and the section will be called Pedophilia in Politics, and we'll get into the issue of control files. A great subscriber comment that I wanted to read to you. The perspectives that I've received from you, your special reports, the Celeria Report, and your incredible guests are so extremely valuable. I now have a viewpoint that is far different, deeper, well-rounded, and something that finally makes personal sense to me. I always somehow knew that the Matrix was a lie, but you've put the details in place in a way that I understand. It has provided me with peace of mind. So glad that you're having John Rappaport every month. I wanted to mention John Rappaport is going to be with us now once a month. He starts July with his first piece. It's going to be called Inside the Medical Matrix. We're also doing something else very special. We'll record it tomorrow night and put it up on the internet. We've decided to go through the timeline on Oklahoma City bombing and the HUD loan sales. You're going to say, what did the two have together in common? You'll see after I go through it with John Rappaport. Again, that'll be up on the internet probably sometime next week. So that's it for Ask Catherine. Keep the questions coming. I really, really appreciate them. Well, our guest tonight is going to join us at 9:20, so I'm going to give you a bit of an introduction. Dale Daugherty, every week I pick a hero, and our hero tonight is Dale. You've heard me say many times when I talk about any action, whether it's an investment or a donation or simply how we use our time, I ask the question, is it decentralizing and is it wealth building? Because what you'll find is if something is decentralizing and wealth building, it has a positive impact on the world. And when you look at Dale Daugherty's career and what he's done, everything he does is decentralizing and wealth building. He's the founder of O'Reilly's Publishing, which is a company out in California in Sonoma County that's done an absolutely wonderful job of making knowledge about new technology accessible. And he runs the Maker division at O'Reilly Publishing, and he's the editor of Make Magazine, which is the magazine of the Maker movement. The Maker movement is highly decentralizing and highly wealth-building. I've been reading about it for a number of years. We have our systems admin, our wonderful systems admin. Alan is a maker, and several of my clients are makers. And from my perspective, there's no better way to build financial equity than to have the skills to, it's called DIY, do it yourself. And having the skills to make things yourself, you know, is in fact the skills that helps us make our world. And so I'm going to talk with Dale tonight about the Maker movement, and let's just see if he's with us. Dale, are you with us yet? No, he's coming back in 2 minutes. I first started reading about the Maker movement. You first started to see articles. There's just a big article in The Economist. But what happened was, you know, for years we've had a do-it-yourself movement of people in the home improvement area. But what has happened as you've had new and very powerful technology, first in computers and digital technology, and now in a variety of other tools like 3D printers, you're now seeing people realize that these tools, particularly where we can create workshops and spaces to share tools like this, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about, there really is more and more ways of doing many more things for ourselves in much more economic ways than we've ever been able to do it before. And I think a lot of it coming out of California and the San Francisco Bay Area, where you have a lot of technologists, we saw this Maker movement get going. And it really has kind of exploded. If you look at the blog post I put up on the link, a blog post I put up on tonight's Celeria Report, we have links to a number of different, a new company called TechSpace, where you can become a member and literally go share a space that has the tools that you need and has classes. Also a link to the Wikipedia entry on hackerspaces, which are basically community spaces where makers go and work together. So take a look at the links. Our movie and Let's Go to the Movie is called Kane's Arcade, and it's really one of those stories that pulls at your heartstring. It's about a young 9-year-old who started to make a penny arcade out of cardboard boxes, and he started to sell cards to come play at his penny arcade and sold a fun pass to someone who got very intrigued by what he was doing and made a little documentary about it, including doing a flash mob, inviting everybody on his Facebook page and his friends' extended Facebook pages to come down to the penny arcade and play it. Well, one thing led to another, and Kane was able to date, according to his website, raise over $200,000 for his education. And it's one of the questions we had from subscribers is, you know, is the maker movement about low-tech things and high-tech things? And what you'll see is there's a very wide spectrum of both. This is an example of very low-tech. But it's a perfect example of what can happen to a child who takes a real interest in making things for themselves and learning how to use their imagination to create things that engage with other people and even generate an income. Dale, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Hi. Well, welcome to the Solari Report. We're thrilled that you would do this, and we know because of the holidays it's a special effort for you, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. It's nice to be able to chat with you.
Well, I've already introduced you before you got here. So
okay, good.
Why don't we just dive in and tell us who are the makers? What is a maker? How do you become a maker? How did this all get started?
Okay. Well, you know, in many ways, making represents kind of a re-engagement with physical things like objects and the processes that we use to create and build things. I started Make Magazine in about 2005, 2006, because I saw people, particularly people that had worked most of their life in software, kind of being re-engaged or re-engaging in hardware and physical things, whether you call them robots or rockets or all kinds of things. And I just saw kind of a renewed interest in like tinkering and the practices of like, oh, just take something apart and figure out what's inside of it and how to use that. And I think in some ways there's always been people doing that kind of thing. I sort of gave it a new name and a kind of a freshened up identity, but you know, if you go back to the early days of the personal computer, people were building kits, Heath kits and others, to really build their first computer. It was a chance to get something they could not buy. And I think we've had a strong streak in engineering and even other disciplines like industrial design of people who really, you know, they not only have ideas, they want to realize those ideas in particular objects. And I think when we reintroduced this idea and called it Make and kind of intentionally said, you know, our audience are makers. They are people who make things. We allowed people who had specific fields of interest to kind of all gather together. And it almost came from like looking at open source and software and thinking about, you know, some of the magic of the open source software movement has been people are aware that there's lots of different projects, whether it's MySQL or PHP or Perl, and yet they kind of feel a certain affinity across those projects for, you can get together and talk about your project. You can talk about, you know, who's working on it, what they do with it. And I thought that's kind of the community we want to build, is people and their projects, and give them a chance to talk about it. It doesn't really matter whether, you know, they're really into optics or they're into acoustics. I mean, they actually would like to get together and talk to each other.
I remember when I was a kid, my uncle describing to me the fact that when he was a kid, he'd taken a whole summer to take apart and put together a Model T Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd taken the next summer and took apart and put together bicycles. And
yeah.
How cool they thought that was. And I remember thinking, you know, why don't we do that? It's so strange that we don't do that.
Right. The other side that I think that's really important is, what do you discover by doing that? Not only simply that how a Model T works or how a bicycle works, but you really are taking apart the world and understanding that things, you know, can be broken down into components and put back together, and even put back together a different way than what you disassembled them.
In 1978, I rode a bicycle cross country, and to do it, I had to learn to take apart and put together the bicycle.
Yeah.
And for a summer, you know, whenever I had a problem with my transportation, I just took it apart and fixed it again, put it back together. And right afterwards, I got on a plane to fly someplace on my first plane trip afterwards. And I had this terrible feeling that if anything went wrong, I couldn't fix it. And it felt terrible.
Yeah.
So I think what is your expression? Yeah, you can make your world. That's your expression, right?
Yeah. Well, something like that, yeah. But I mean, I think it, you know, if you, you know, I think we're used to this idea in software that we can change things easily. Like, where's the profile or preferences? Where do I, change the color or change the visibility of something? And I feel like as a generation, we're getting so used to computers that we now kind of look at the physical world. Or you get in a car, and you know, I think a Prius kind of did something like this, but, you know, where's the menu? You know, where do I change what's on that dashboard? and you kind of think about your house, like, well, how do I control these lights? I don't like the way they come on, or I like to, you know, do that. And we start thinking, and it was kind of the seminal idea, I think, behind the magazine was hacking your world, you know, that you would start to apply the ideas of hacking that we have from software to the physical environment we spend all our time in.
Right. How much of this has come out of new technologies? I mean, if you look at what's happening in new technologies, whether it's robotics or 3D printing or any of these things, you know, suddenly we do have new tools that could be very, very powerfully decentralizing.
Well, I think in ways that I didn't really appreciate at the time, that sort of, you know, MAKE got started, and then I think some of this new technology started to take off almost coincidentally, but I think it's very important to the growth of the maker movement and what it means for people and innovation. 3D printer, I think, I've given some talks, and if you recall, because this is kind of how I got started in technology, it wasn't the computer itself that got me engaged, it was the laser printer. You know, and
really?
the laser printer, you know, allowed you to create something on a computer that then you could share with other people. I'm a writer, and that kind of, you know, O'Reilly as a company really gets started doing computer manuals and computer books because, hey, we have all the tools we need on a computer to do that. But it's the laser printer is the key piece there. And the laser printer comes out of Xerox and is sort of popularized by HP and Apple. And if you kind of think about what that did, is it really opened the door for creative people to begin using computers, people with a graphic arts background.
Right.
We needed new software like, PageMaker. We needed standards like PostScript. We had a rich ecosystem for creating your work, and I call it kind of the rise of creatives, and those creatives went on to do, they moved from page design then from web to web design pretty easily, and the kind of the second wave of creatives were really doing things that just existed on the computer, and I think makers are like a third wave that is now looking and say, oh, once again we can use computers to design and model things, but we can also push a print button and get a 3D object out of that.
Well, I also think of makers as people who are punching through the force field that says, you know, it's only good if you buy it in a store. It's only good if it's slick and comes from a big corporation. Somehow, we've lost the ability to kind of do it ourselves as a as a sort of commitment to the power of our own imagination and ability to build a higher learning metabolism.
Right.
And somehow
it's almost a surrender.
That whole thing.
To that, you know? It's almost like, well, who are we to build that? And this is where I think making is connected to other things in our lives. I think, for instance, you know, like, why do you raise your own, you know, grow your own food? Or why do you make your own dinner instead of just going out and buying, you know, something from the store? And I think, you know, some of the answers to that, I think, are very similar to why we want to make things, is because you like the way it tastes, or you like to know where your food comes from. You feel connected. You feel differently about that, and you feel more invested in the process, say, of cooking your dinner. I was kind of, you know, one of my ways I thought of make early on is I said, well, think of it as like Martha Stewart for geeks. And what I kind of meant by that was that, you know, she sort of got to, you know, you do these things and even aspire to do these things because of, you know, sort of what it means to you to make a pie, for instance. You know, people are coming
right.
over and you take the time to make bread or make a pie. It's something that you like to do inherently, but it also means something in a social context. And I think of making in a similar way is it's a demonstration of what you can do, and it's something you can be proud of. But it also leads to interesting places, in particular leads to kind of relationships with other people, which is something that hobbies have always done for us. I think, you know, when you engage in a hobby, you're a rank amateur and you're embarrassed practically to talk to anybody else, but you begin meeting people who are just like you, and you meet a community that wants to share their ideas and welcome you, and that's a really positive experience to have.
Now, you started the Maker Faires. And I've never
yes.
been to a Maker Fair, but I've encouraged a whole bunch of people in my network to go, and I keep getting these great reports,
yes.
including from the last one. I think it was just in San Francisco.
Yes.
So could you explain the history, what a Maker Fair is, and the history of how this got going?
Sure.
And if we were to go, walk us through a Maker Fair, who would we meet and what would be going on?
Well, it's increasingly a particular one here. So it's, you know, we had over 100,000 people over 2 days. So first of all, you'd see a lot of people. But the core of the idea when I started the magazine was I was fascinated about what people were building and making and the reasons they had for doing that and how it I just thought, this is stuff we don't get to see every day. There's no other place that it sort of becomes visible, and a lot of this stuff is private. It's done in your garage or it's done in a basement. So I wanted to kind of create this fun event where people would bring what they've been working on and set up a table and talk to other people about it. I wanted not only the thing that they're making, but I wanted the maker themselves to talk about, because behind makers are enthusiasts, and I think it's just a wonderful trait that when you see it in someone, it's infectious. You can't help feel something for them. And they're infectious. They're enthusiasts about the knowledge they have. They're enthusiasts about the tools they use. They're enthusiasts about, you know, the kind of participation they have in a community. And it sort of turns out that almost everybody of every age can connect to them. You know, you don't really have to care about someone who's doing this, but when they're building a tank to raise jellyfish in their yard, you know, like, I've never thought of doing that, but it's fascinating to talk to someone who's doing that and working at it. And like, what are the problems? Why are jellyfish different than, you know, guppies? And, you know, how long do they live? How do they breed? You know, it just leads us into a brand new world. And so Maker Faire, I really wanted to kind of find those people. And I knew they kind of existed. And a lot of times I think of it as these are creative people doing interesting things with technology. They're often spanning one or two fields in a kind of interdisciplinary way. They're amateurs, but it doesn't mean what they do is amateurish. So I just thought, well, I meet these people through the magazine. I find them fascinating. Do you think they would like to meet each other, first of all, and do you think we could get them together in an event and the public would enjoy it? And we kind of shaped it as a fair because of almost the heritage of fairs in an agricultural society is people lived on remote farms and they got together to share their work, you know, their pigs and their pies, and they got a chance to learn from each other. And I thought, well, the fair is still a relevant context here, but a lot of the existing fairs are really still about agriculture and not about what people are really doing today. And so I think if you walked around Maker Faire, you'd kind of have a sense that you were seeing a bunch of things you normally don't get to see. You'd see stuff that's fun, crazy, fire arts. People have lots of reasons for making, and some are, they have business reasons for doing. They're trying to make something that they hope one day they could sell. But a lot of people are doing it because they love what they're doing. They want to make you smile. They want to capture your attention. We have things like a 19-foot-tall giraffe, robotic giraffe that moves around and is all lit up with lights. And we have Architect, which takes giant Tesla coils and they play live music through them. So you have rock and roll, and you have these lightning bolts in the sky. So it's
traveling cupcakes.
Yeah, the muffins. But the interesting thing, Maker Faire, is we're trying to also, we want you to become a maker, and we have lots of activities, lots of places where you might sit down, and amidst all the hubbub and roar, you're learning to solder, you're learning to embroider, you're learning to do things that are part of sort of the DIY skill set.
There's a wide selection from very low-tech to very high-tech.
Yes.
So
yes.
You don't need to be a technologist to get involved.
No. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons, I wanted to be inclusive of even traditional crafts and arts and I feel some of them are getting a bit lost in our busy world, and they still have value to us. There's still people practicing them, but particularly for the next generation, there's something meaningful about using your hands and doing things in an analog way. Our brain is really geared to working that way, and I think we forget that sometimes.
The first Maker Faire was in 2005?
When was
the first
one? I think it was 6. I think it was 2006. And it was in,
okay, so this was 2012. Yeah. 6 years later, you're up to 100,000 people.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, I wasn't sure, like, even the first year how many we get. We got something like 20,000, and I went to 40,000 the year after. So this year there'll be 60 Maker Faires around the world. So they're smaller. They're not 100,000. They might be a couple thousand people. But after the one in May last June, I visited Seoul, Korea, where they had their first Maker Faire. And, while it was just a couple stories of a gallery, It had kids there, it had families there. They had lots of fun, exciting projects. And the makers are just excited to be there and doing this and sharing with each other.
Now, can you explain what hackerspaces are?
Sure. So hackerspaces, and there's really kind of a class of things that go by different names, but such as makerspaces, fab labs, tech shop. They're kind of little differences, but they're very similar. It's really like a community-based workshop where you have tools, specialized like 3D printers or laser cutters. You have materials, but probably more importantly, you have some set of experts and people who can help you there. A hackerspace is tended to be like a private club. 10 people get together, say, we'll rent this a couple thousand square feet. We'll work together on building it out, and we'll share our tools, and we'll have workshops now and then, invite people in to teach something. Tech shop is a commercial model where it's, as a company, they're building out these spaces. They have 3 in the San Francisco Bay Area. They've opened one in Detroit. And it's a membership model, gym membership model. You pay $100 a month, and you can go there and use the space and use the tools to take workshops. And Fab Lab is a bit more of an academic version that but roughly the same set of equipment and but placed in you know, that could be at a community college or a four-year college. I've been working on sort of maker spaces as an idea of for education, but both formal and informal. Like, how do we get, in a sense, kind of reinvent the shop class and,
right,
you know, replace some of the old machinery with new tools like 3D printers? How do we get kids creating and building and producing things? And this is my key, I think, key idea for them is I really want them to see themselves as makers, as creators, not just as consumers, even in education, not just as consumers of content,
right,
but really people that are creating and making things.
Well, it's interesting. I was looking at the classes at one of the tech shops, and mm-hmm. a lot of the classes centered around learning the individual tools. And what you could see is if you took I guess the youngest you can go into tech shop is, I think, 12. Mm-hmm. Unless, or you have to be a certain age unless you're with your parents. But I could literally see a child sort of learning tool after tool after tool. And then once they had a certain number of tools, the range of what they could make with it is
sure.
pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, the interesting the thing that you're onto there is, you know, we can talk to kids like, do you have a rich imagination? Many kids do. But, you know, the other idea that we're trying to teach kids is how to realize something that's an idea, how to take advantage of
right.
it. And sometimes, you know, being more familiar with tools or being familiar with materials allows us to sort of realize, hey, this is the way to go. This is how I could do it. And even when we were talking about earlier about taking things apart, you go, well, this thing that I want to build is a little bit like a bicycle because, you know, there's rotary motion, you know, or something. You know, it's you
right.
begin to build a vocabulary for how things work and more importantly, how you would, in a sense, remix the physical world by putting, you know, something together with something else that nobody has ever thought of.
You know, one of the things as this kind of automation rolls out throughout the economy, you know, you have more and more people who have less and less income. But the interesting thing is they have more and more time. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, the fundamental economics are changing where it just makes much more economic sense to make a lot more for ourselves. And
yeah.
so I think one of the questions is can the maker movement help people, inspire people, particularly young people, to see that opportunity? After the Housing Act passed in 2008, I used to be Assistant Secretary of Housing, and this Housing Act passed, and it was hundreds of pages of long. And I sat down and I read it, and I live near an intentional community in Tennessee called The Farm, and they have home building courses.
Well, I know
and
that,
I always
yeah.
thought, oh, you know, it's much too hard to sit down and learn how to make your own home. And I read this new housing bill, and I called my attorney, whose son at the time was 16, and I said, you know, we ought to have Christian take the courses on home building, because if you look at how complex this system is becoming, you know, if you're 16, it's just easier and much more practical to learn how to build your own home.
Yeah.
You know, so the economics are changing.
My son did that. You know.
Really?
Yeah.
He did that course or he learned how to build a
no,
home?
No, but he built his own home and you know, he'd never done it before, but he was, you know, a combination of tapping expertise of other people and a
uh-huh.
desire and persistence to do it himself, you know, he figured it out.
Oh, how wonderful.
So, you know, and I think, you know, one of the things that this also ties into, you know, is really once you have a certain level of confidence in learning and you know how you learn and you begin to see, you know, where the resources are that you need, whether it's people or books or websites. And this
right.
is what I think is just like this golden era of DIY now. You know, we talk about other eras like the 50s, but we have so much information online, you know, that we could never think of accessing. And the kid that, you know, grew up in a neighborhood, you know, in the 50s, you know, if their father knew how to handle tools had a workshop. You might have picked that up from that person. But what if you didn't? What if you, like mine, my father didn't really do that. I didn't really pick it up that way. But, you know, through the internet, it doesn't necessarily matter who your father is or who your neighbor is or who your teacher is. You can, you know, if you get exposed to something and you figure out what you want to do, you can find people out there who can help you.
Well, this is why I think the open source community has really helped us remember all these things, because it's really demonstrated how collaborative efforts through time and space can get an enormous amount accomplished, and it really does work.
Yes, and we don't all have to, you know, what I kind of think of some things like Maker, and when you say open source, is there's a lot of activity that happens, say, in a city or in our own lives it's not commerce, you know, that we share because for lots of reasons. We get something out of it, you know, or someone asks us a question, we give them the best answer we know. And I think of like this, that, you know, almost a lot of what's happening in the Maker, these enthusiasts, they're like pre-commercial, it's pre-commercial activity.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it leads to business. But, you know, open source, it isn't necessarily like you make money on open source, but it's a kind of, it's a foundation for lots of people working together who don't care what business you're in or what your title is, or, you know, and you work together and you create things that you're able to use in different ways to create value.
Well, unfortunately, right now we have a financial system that more often than not is stripping value out.
Yeah.
So I think people are looking to say, okay, well, where can I make and contribute value where it won't just be destroyed or harvested, and you know, where we can circulate. There was I can't remember his name, but there's a wonderful software developer who put up, he's working on plans for I think it's the 50 tools that make an agriculture community go.
Yes. Yes.
And you know, they're the plans for the hardware of how to build your own tractor, how to build your own
college.
And I love it because it's a vision of complete economic you know, independence that is absolutely feasible if enough people get together and start, you know, making things together.
It's hard, though. I mean, I think a lot of, you know, I think in the 70s, a lot of sort of DIY stuff was driven by the goal of self-sustainability. That's a lot of work and pretty hard for a lot of people.
Oh, but I don't think it's a zero to one thing. I think you know, you make for yourself what is energizing to make for yourself, mm-hmm. and it's not zero or one. It's every little bit counts. I was going to ask you, has there been any sort of real networking between the homeschooling community and the Maker movement? Because I come from a part of the country where the homeschooling movement is huge and growing, and to me, Maker.
Where is that?
I live in Tennessee.
Tennessee,
and,
okay.
And if you look at something like Tech Shop, it's every homeschooler's dream.
Yeah.
Come true.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing too. I think in California we have a pretty healthy homeschooling community, and we have an education day on Maker Faire on the Friday before Maker Faire, and we get a pretty good turnout from homeschoolers because they're able to leave the school day and join us. The other interesting things like Tech Shop, Maker Spaces, and Hacker Spaces I think one of the ways they would be used in communities is by people homeschooling, because homeschoolers don't have labs and workshops easily accessible. And I've had some interest from folks there. And I think the other side of homeschooling is it tends to promote self-directed learning, which is what I feel is almost like the ultimate trait that you're trying, you know, being teach a kid how to, you know, how they learn so that they're learning to learn and they begin to realize that they get to drive the car. You know, it makes a big difference to them rather than sit down and listen and be, you know, just stay in your seat. I think there's some interesting innovation coming from homeschoolers and you know, some of them say, you know, even rethinking how kids spend their time in the day is part of that way of rethinking what kids need to be able to do.
Okay, so I'm sitting here and I'm listening to you, and I've never been to a Maker Faire, and, you know, I haven't really thought about this. And I think, well, you know, this, I hear this, and this is really cool, and this is something I might like to check out or get involved.
Mm-hmm.
How do I dip my toe in the water? How do I
sure.
start? Where do
well,
I go?
I think,
what do I do?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. One is, you don't just start talking to people that you know. Almost the way I sort of figured out the magazine was worth doing was just talking about the idea of making to people, and they already start talking about what they were doing. So that's you want to kind of look in your own community physically.
Uh-huh.
I think of, you know, is there a hackerspace or a makerspace around? Is there a mini Maker Faire nearby? These are good ways to sort of get introductions to making. Online, there's not only our site, makezine.com, but there's instructables.com. There's a lot of places you can go to get information about projects and things. And I think it doesn't necessarily matter whether you're, you know, I'd say, like, find something you're interested in and look for communities that are doing something. And some are online, but a lot of them, you know, are in your neighborhood. And DIY workshops and other things, like if you wanted to learn to program Arduino, look, you know, start seeing if there are any workshops in your area. So there's, I think some of that is like re-engage with the community around you. There's a lot of, certainly online, we provide a lot of stuff there. We provide the magazine in print and online. But I think, you know, sometimes the first step is, like, how do you get making something?
Mm-hmm. And what about your kids and grandkids?
Well, I don't have grandkids yet, but but in general, you know, there's kind of an interesting thing. I say the big surprise for me is every year Maker Faire and all that we're doing here seems to get younger and younger. It seems to be reaching a younger audience. The magazine particular seems to strike a chord with teenagers who think this is cool, like the way a skateboarding magazine would be cool. And they look at it and say, hey, I'd like to be able to do this stuff. I wouldn't have predicted it when I started because I didn't
And what are the kids interested in making? Are they, do they show a difference?
Well, you know, the magazine's pretty broad. You know, the simple idea sometimes of, you know, often some of the basic projects we start people with is just, you know, here's a battery, here's some wires, and here's LEDs. And you know, lighting a light. You know, you watch them oh, it went on. Look at that. You know, it went off. It went on. It went off. It went on. Yeah, it's just they are manipulating, controlling, changing something. And I think it is, but they kind of see where that is, that they're directing that and not something else. So I think those basic things, like working with LEDs, music is a rich area. Another area
that's
kind of fun.
They make their own instruments?
Yeah, and synthesizers and speakers and amplifiers. Another area that's kind of fun is sort of fashion, where we sometimes called e-textiles, where they're incorporating elements like LEDs into something that you might, you know, add to a hoodie or add to a scarf or add to a glove. I think the idea is...
So you're wearing lights?
Yeah, yeah. And,
yeah?
Or a little display that says something. You know, we had one project in the magazine called the pulse sensor headband, and you know, it's just like you wore a little thing on your finger that was picking up your pulse, and the headband had lights on it that flashed in, you know, in a rhythm with your pulse. So it's a, you know, one way of thinking about it is a lot of the projects have to do with sensing the physical world and translating that into something expressive, something fun.
So it sounds to me like what you want to do is find the local place, whatever it is, get your kid down there and get them making something.
Right. And, you know, to realize that there's a lot, you can get started with cheap materials. You know, you can be inspired by 100-year-old popular mechanics. You know, I did, when I started the magazine, I went back and looked at those and And I just thought, you know, shooting off a rocket in your backyard or a soda bottle rocket is still kind of fun, you know. We don't get over that, you know.
Yeah.
So I was about to say, with kids, you know, the younger kids, I think making is a way for parents to have sort of meaningful interactions with their kids. You know, how do you build this? Working together, letting them do it. And if they get frustrated, you help them out a bit, but try to get them, you know, let them take control as much as they can. But it's playful. And I think from an education perspective, and, you know, we've sometimes been taking play out of kids' lives. I'd like to put it back in, and in a sense, it's not the package toy that's so interesting. It's the toy you build yourself, and it's the toy you get to play with. And a lot of things, I don't care whether race cars or other things, you know, once you start playing with them, you want to improve them. You want to figure out what makes it go fast, and how do I change the wheels, or how do I change the motor? And that's human mind just at work, kind of figuring out how to invent and create.
Well, the video I put up on the blog for tonight was the little movie, the documentary short, Kane's Arcade, about the 9-year-old in Los Angeles who makes a penny arcade out of cardboard boxes from an auto parts supply store.
Yeah.
So, exactly. You know, it's just what's in the recycled from the back of an auto parts.
Right.
You know, there's no fancy materials. It's just that and scotch tape.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't take much, you know.
You see from that thing that what it takes is really a child having confidence that they can apply their imagination.
Yeah.
And if they just keep building and learning and building and learning, and they, you know, because this kid just never gives up. He just keeps going until, in fact, the thing somehow catches on.
Yeah, and I think the important thing is that there's a social context for this that makes a difference. You know, it isn't just a kid working by themselves. They, you know, and I think this is what you get from Maker Faires. When you see all this work from all these people, it inspires you. You know, you look at bicycles differently. You look at, you know, robots differently. You say, I never thought of that, you know, and it gets your mind going, and it makes you think about what you could do.
Caroline Casey, who's a radio show host on KPFA Radio, had a suggestion once where she said, look, take your home, you know, pick a room, and over time just try and convert the furniture in that room until everything in that room comes from somebody you know who made it, and you have a personal story to the person who made it, and you have the personal story of how they made it and how it came to be.
Yeah.
And you create an intimacy in your space, which is completely changes the feel of your life. And so over the next couple of years, I tried it, and it completely converted the nature of the room to something completely different, because it was really part of, you know, everything connected me to a community of people who made things.
And I think that's kind of the antidote to, you know, sort of disposable consumerism, you know, where you just buy and throw things away. And I think partly we've almost kind of lost the connection to physical objects, that they don't have any meaning to us because we just think of them as cheap things we throw out. And I think that example is, well, you know, if you made that thing, you know, there's a story behind that. And people walk into that room and you say, you made that. And they say, really? How did you do that? And you know, it's not unlike the pie or the bread. People want to know more about it. If you say, I just got that at IKEA, you know, was it hard to assemble? You know, that's the kind of conversation you have, you know?
Okay, well, tell us, just take a moment and tell us a little bit more about, I know, because you, in addition to being the editor of Make Magazine, you also run the Maker Division. So if you could just introduce us to what O'Reilly's doing, both the magazine and anything else in the Maker Division, and how we plug in and connect. I just subscribed to the magazine, so now I get to say I'm a subscriber.
Well, I'm, you know, the makezine.com is our main website and our sort of active community for makers, and you can get information about the magazine there. We also have something called Maker Shed. That is, we sell kits and other, you know, things that help people get started making things, like getting started with Arduino, which is sort of a book and a kit that tell you, provide the physical pieces you need to make stuff, as long with as some of the expertise. And then Maker Faire is our division for running events. Our next Maker Faire will be in New York City in mid-September, makerfaire.com. Faire has an E in that.
Where in the city is it going to be? Is it down at the convention center?
It's at the New York Hall of Science in Queens. It'll be our third year.
Wow.
It's the site of the old World's Fair, you know, from 67.
That's going to be amazing.
Some of those things. And it was a building that was designed as the Hall of Science for the World's Fair. So we do most of the fair outside on the ground around the fair, but not but we use a few of the facilities indoors. But it's a very nice
and
event.
At your website we can find if we can't make New York, we can find links to
Next year's event,
world, really.
But we can also find mini maker fairs that might be closer to you, and they're really good family experiences. As everyone seems to have fun at them.
Well, you didn't hear because I did it before you came in. But every week we have a hero on the Solari Report, and our hero is always somebody who finds a way of decentralizing the economy and but in ways that are wealth building. And this week you were our hero.
Well, thank you. That's a good thing. I think that's a really I appreciate that. I mean, I do like how this sort of makers are taking back, you know, a bit of small business and trying to, you know, figure out how to create value. And I think one of the lessons I say to people, I said, what can I learn from the maker movement? I said, well, one of the things is anybody can join it. You know, there's no central bureau for being a maker. You just decide this is what you want to do, and you connect to other people who are doing it. And I think that's kind of at the heart, this is the lesson of empowerment. People, you have information, you have tools, you have ways of people to connect. But, you know, ultimately DIY is about getting started yourself and then figuring it out with the help of other people and other resources.
It's a Curtis Mayfield thing. You don't need a ticket. You just get on board.
That's right.
Well, give us your website again, because I want to make sure it's a wonderful website. It's a wonderful magazine. I want to make sure everybody.
Sorry, I missed that.
So one more time, just give us your website again, because it's a wonderful website and it's a wonderful magazine.
Thank you.
I want to make sure everybody can.
Makezine, MakeZine.com. Makezine.com.
Okay. Well, Dale, thank you again so much for joining us. It's
You're welcome.
Always great
thank you, Kat.
To hear from one of our heroes, and you have a wonderful holiday weekend, okay?
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. You too.
Okay.
I grew up in Kentucky, not too far from Tennessee, so you live in a beautiful part of the world too.
Yeah, it is. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this week. Next week, Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. And then July 19th, we have the second quarter wrap-up and the with the wrap-up this time, I'm going to be doing an equities markets overview. And then again, July 26th, we will post. We won't record it live. We'll record it earlier that week and then post on Thursday John Rappaport's first monthly report for us. And it will be called this month Inside the Medical Matrix. So until next week, Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.